I had practiced for 15 years, both as an associate, then became a partner. And then I jumped out during the dot-com era and worked as a senior executive at a very well-funded internet company. And it was an amazing experience. I kind of always joke that, you know, there's a great quote that says that experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted.
Welcome to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Millard Chan and Andrew Moss launched this podcast to give a voice to the countless founders, angel investors, incubators, supporters, and startup events located in San Diego.
Welcome back to another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Andrew, how are you doing, man?
I'm not too bad. We're recording off-site today in a new location.
That's right, in the offices of Mintz Levin. Really nice building. Cool facilities.
Yeah, they did a great job here, and it looks great, and only friendly faces we've seen so far, so.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, Tech Coast Angels is going to be here recording on Friday. I think they're selecting their first batch, the first cut for a quick pitch of 2017.
Yeah, I believe that's what they're doing, and cut it down from, I'm not sure how many they start out with, but we're getting close to 10, I believe, at this point.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Quick Pitch this year. Should be really cool. They've Tech Coast Angels has joined forces with San Diego Venture Group, and so they've upped the total awards to $50,000, which is amazing. $30,000 for their first prize winner.
That can really make or break a company, that $30,000. So you just never know what you're going to see, and the quality of the companies that come through. It's well worth attending the event when it comes around.
Gets better and better each year. They've got great coaches, of course, mentoring these companies for 4 to 6 weeks before the actual quick pitch day.
Yep, I did it last year, and the company that I mentored actually came in second place. So it was a nice surprise to see that happen.
Well done, dude. Well done. Our guest is Jeremy D. Glazer, who's a member of the law firm of Mintz Levin, where he serves as co-chair of the firm's venture capital and emerging companies practice. For more than 30 years, Jeremy has helped companies raise angel and venture financing and achieve successful liquidity events such as IPOs and sales in the software, mobile applications, biotech, medical devices, and clean energy sectors. Jeremy, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you on. So tell us a little bit, like, your background. How did you start pursuing law? What was the interest there in the first place?
Sure. So I think I always knew I was going to be a lawyer. Even as a young kid, I remember taking one of these exams where they determined what were your skills, and they said, and I had said I wanted to be a lawyer, and they said, yeah, we could see that. You could definitely be a lawyer. So I think it was always there. But what really got me interested in pursuing what I do now is I've always had a love for technology and particularly for entrepreneurship. And so even when I was in law school, I actually had a little startup business that I built and then sold when I graduated. And you can call it kind of a tech business, but really it was using some very early on PC technology to provide some services to law school students around, like, resumes and so on. It was a fun little business, but again, that entrepreneurial spirit has always been in me. And so wanting to work with, you know, young companies and entrepreneurs really is what drove me to want to become an attorney.
That's tremendous credibility of having done that while you were in law school.
Yes.
You built this and then sold it out. That's that's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. And I've had others too. We'll talk about them, of course, during this discussion. I've had other entrepreneurial experiences where I went out and experienced what my clients have experienced and learned a lot doing that.
That's really important, right? So, I mean, just like when I talk to fellow founders that work with people that they view as advisors and mentors, and I always say, just because someone was a great Fortune 500 executive doesn't mean they have the right skills to advise a founder or a founding team at that startup level.
I completely agree. And, you know, I had practiced for 15 years, both as an associate, then became a partner. And then I jumped out during the dot-com era and worked as a senior executive at a very well-funded internet company. And it was an amazing experience. I kind of always joke that, you know, there's a great quote that says that experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted. And that's definitely true. It happened here. But after being in a company, and we could talk a lot about what I learned, but it really dramatically changed the way I practice law at a lot of different levels, particularly with early stage companies. It gave me so much more awareness of the necessity of being very responsive, of really, you know, answering their calls and being quick to get back to them, because you know, when they were calling and I knew what it was like on the other end of the phone, there was a reason that I picked up the phone to call the lawyer and I needed some advice then and there. It wasn't okay to wait a day or two. And we could talk a lot more about other things I've learned, but it was very eye-opening to be in a technology company during that time.
Actually, let's take a deeper dive into that, because I've worked with a number of attorneys back when I was in big company days, and there's always this pro and con versus working at law firm versus working at an operating company. So what were the advantages and disadvantages for you?
Sure. So, and again, I think for me, because I had been an outside lawyer for so many years, it was actually very beneficial to then have that experience to go inside to a very, you know, hyperactive technology company. This company was backed by big venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia, Oak, Meritech. It was all poised to go public, actually, when I joined the company. And so, and if you remember during the, you know, the dot-com boom, that 1999 to, you know, mid-2000, early 2001.
Yeah, I graduated business school into the dot-com era. I had a lot of fun for a couple years.
It was very hyperactive, right? And this company was just flying, like, really high. It had raised well over $100 million of capital. It was poised in the private markets from basically venture capitalists. It was planning to go public. So stepping into that environment and then being directly engaged with the people developing the technology. So I wasn't just the in-house lawyer. I was also heading up business development. So I was working directly with the developers of the technology, with the program managers, things like that, project managers. And gosh, there was just so many learning experiences. But I'd say of the many things I learned, the one major thing that I took away from it was to recognize that to be a successful attorney, you need to apply a lot of the same skills that these technology companies are applying. What do I mean by that? Planning out a project, budgeting out a project, bringing everybody who's involved in that project together and making sure they all understand, they've all bought in, that they all have their input, communicating on a regular basis so things don't get dropped or missed and people don't get surprised at the end. And intuitively, I knew all that, but I wasn't implementing it in a way that was really effective for a hyperactive early stage company when I was just practicing for 15 years. So that experience of being inside really added a whole nother flavor to the way I practiced law, both from communications with clients, being clear about costs, clear about budgets, developing processes to actually control costs in a way that's been very effective. I've been using now for, gosh, you know, crazy to say it, 16 years. It's amazing. Here it is, 2017, right?
I mean, yeah, the fact that you're able to apply these skills as a lawyer, it's an invaluable asset to give your clients, I think. You know, I'm sure there aren't many lawyers like yourself that can do that sort of take a mentorship role like that. And it's nice that you can differentiate yourself, basically.
I think so, Andrew. And, you know, especially as a lawyer who works with a lot of early stage companies, so much of what I'm doing is I'm looking at a business model. I'm trying to help them think about, is this going to be successful? Can you get this funded by angels? Can you get this funded by venture capitalists? What does the end game look? How big of a business can this be? And I'm helping them. I'm assessing that for myself as to, is this a company that I think I can be helpful to and that I want to work with? But I'm also assessing it for them. I'm helping them position in the right way. And having been inside and having had that experience just adds a whole nother flavor to what I was doing all along. And I think I've gotten, better at it. I think I'm more valuable at it. Although also just, you know, 30 plus years of reading business plans and exec summaries and, you know, helping people put together PowerPoint presentations and sitting in meetings with multiple venture capitalists. You get a lot of experience that you can pass on to people.
So coming from the standpoint of a early stage founder, there's two questions I'd like to ask Jeremy. So one is, when should a founder find and start working with an attorney or start evaluating attorneys or law firms? And two is, how best to work together with an attorney with the mind to kind of keep costs down, but also utilizing the valuable insights? Having done this myself, it's really a challenging thing.
So, you know, it's interesting. Early on in my career, I've always been at pretty large law firms. We typically weren't working with the really early stage companies, true startups. We would typically pick a company up when they were getting a venture capital term sheet. That was kind of the normal time that they came inside the large law firm environment. That's completely changed. And now large law firms like Mintz Levin, we've designed programs that are specifically designed for very small companies so that we can work with them very efficiently and very effectively. And our competitors have done this as well. So in the old days, I would say, you know, it's fine, you know, go work with a very small firm so you can keep your costs down in the beginning. And then once you get that venture capital term sheet, come see the large firms like ourselves. But today, that's not really the case. Today, we've got programs that we can help companies be very efficient, get them formed, get their stock issued, help them get convertible note deals done or very basic Series seed financings done really inexpensively. And a lot of it's due to technology. We've invested in a lot of automation, so we have a lot of automated documentation that can spit things out, you know, quite efficiently. And a lot of it is also, you know, we talked about this earlier, is just communication, right? Being able to tell the founder, hey, look, if you only want to spend X on doing a convertible note deal, you got to keep it simple. And here's the way to keep it simple. And if it's going to get more complicated, then it might get more expensive. And it's amazing to me how often attorneys don't have that conversation with the client.
Why is that?
You know, I've actually asked myself that question a lot over the years. I think it's because lawyers just aren't trained that way, right? Lawyers are people who are very good academically. They excel in their college degrees. They go to law school, and if they're working at a big law firm, they excelled in the law firms. So they're very intellectual. They love to solve problems, but they were never really taught about how to be a business person. They weren't taught about things like what do things cost and how do you explain cost and how do you do a budget and how do you work to a budget and how do you make decisions where maybe you're not going to be getting the A-plus answer because maybe in certain situations, you know, the B answer is actually okay for now as long as the client understands what that means and what the risks are. I think it's a very different mindset being an entrepreneur and running a startup company than the way lawyers are typically trained. You know, again, I think that's there's certainly lawyers who've changed that mentality, and I've tried to certainly, you know, be one of those people. So it's not everybody, but I do think that's part of the issue, that they haven't been trained that way, they don't think that way, they haven't run businesses, they've never had to deal with budgets and financial statements and, you know, and matching those up and making sure that the business was still going to be around tomorrow.
So if I'm a seed stage entrepreneur, Jeremy, how would I even make that first step to, regardless if it's a small firm lawyer or a large firm lawyer, how do I make contacts with these attorneys to determine who's right for me?
Sure. So I think the reality is you got to get yourself networked. Wherever you are, yeah, you got to really get into the kind of the startup environment in whatever town you're in. So, you know, here in San Diego, we're really fortunate. We have a lot of great organizations that are focused on helping entrepreneurs building their businesses. So if you go, whether it's TCA or San Diego Venture Group or Evo Nexus or in the biotech space, Biocom, if you go to their events, you're going to meet people who are going to be able to give you their input, their guidance about, hey, who are the people in the community that are really focused on helping people like you start your business, build your business, and get successful. So I think that's always the best, right, to get a specific referral. Now, look, obviously, you know, we live in the day and age of, you know, you can Google everything.
Right.
So you certainly can go on the internet and see who is active in the space. You can look at people's websites. You know, I've personally gotten very active on doing videos. So I've got videos that are posted on YouTube, on our Mint's Edge website, which is the website that we built for startup companies. And I think if someone were to Google those, they'd pull those up. And I think you'd see, again, that there's certain attorneys who are very active in communicating information to startups. And that's where you want to go, right? You don't, I always kind of joke, you know, if you're having a heart attack, you don't want to go to your general practitioner, right? You want to go to the cardiologist. Well, it's the same with the lawyers, right? If you're going to start up a company, you don't want to go to, you know, the small firm that does, you know, small litigation projects. You want to find the expert who works with entrepreneurs, does seed financings, does venture financings every day, all the time.
That kind of leads me to another question because, I mean, you seem to be kind of out ahead in this sort of sense where you've gone out and not only just been a lawyer, but you've gone to work at a startup and, you know, you've had experiences outside of being a lawyer. Are you seeing more of a pattern of that now with other lawyers and where it can definitely help entrepreneurs, or is it still sort of same old where, you know, it is as is from years ago?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, so interestingly, here at Mintz, we've actually gone out of our way to hire people who've had, you know, experience inside companies, either as in-house counsel or as business people. We really value that and we look for that. But I think most lawyers, that's not the path they take. I think they go to law school, they go to a law firm, they spend their career in the law firm. And I'd say before I had that experience, back during the dot-com era, I felt like that was probably perfectly normal and okay. But having had the experience, I actually now am a firm believer that it's good, especially for lawyers that are working with growing companies, technology companies. I think it's good to get out. And even if it's on a temporary basis, you know, go spend a year in a company. See what's really happening. Understand the frenetic pace of a startup and, you know, the long hours, the working nights, you know, the risks that people are taking. Understand the way they're managing their costs and controls so you can understand and be sensitive to what their needs are. I don't think you can experience that secondhand. I think you have to be in it, see it and live it.
Sure, on the ground, basically. It sounds like almost like a study abroad program you're suggesting here.
It would be great. You know, it's funny. Law firms for years have had these programs where they'll take litigators and put them out into the court systems so that they can get more experience on litigation and actually court time. But law firms don't have that kind of like outplaced process for business lawyers. There's some, but usually it's like maybe outsourcing to like an international law firm, but not really outsourcing to a company with the understanding that you're going to come back in a year or two.
So how best for the entrepreneurs to work with the lawyers? For example, when should they lean on the lawyer for strategy discussions as opposed to more tactical projects like closing a fundraising round or looking to get acquired through M&A?
Sure. So, Millie, look, it obviously depends on the attorney you're working with, right? Again, I think there's a lot of lawyers out there. I try to, you know, include myself in that group that want to be involved very directly in the business decisions. And so we'll make ourselves available, outside of business hours, right? So I've had this thing that I've done for years with my clients. And my deal is on Saturday mornings, you know, starting at 8, not too early, until around noon, you can call me anytime you want. My phone's always with me. And I'm going to be there to answer business questions. You're never going to get billed for that time. That's just time that's available.
Wait, would you just repeat that again? You're never going to get billed for that time from like 8 to 12 on Saturdays?
8 to 12 on Saturdays. Again, if you're just asking for a phone call to talk about, but if you're calling me and say, I need to do a merger document by noon, you're going to get charged for that. I can promise you.
Okay, so for the listeners, that's really, really important. I know that when I was a startup founder, I was always balancing when do I get this good advice that I would need from attorney versus what I have in my bank account, knowing the type of rates I was getting charged. But, you know, if you offer that service, that's tremendous for your clients, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think it's really important. Again, I want to be very involved in the business. I want them to be tapping into the experience that I've had and seeing a lot of businesses grow and succeed. And to be honest, a lot of businesses fail. And that, I think, has a lot of value. And I want to share that. But I also know realistically, you know, my rate is high, kind of embarrassingly high, if you ask me. And it's not something that I think is appropriate to be charging them for that kind of advice and conversation. So I've always had this time that I've set aside. I also, tell every client, take me to lunch, right? You're going to get an hour of great conversation about the things you want to talk about, and it's going to cost you, 10, 15 bucks, right? That's a great way to do it, too. And so I make myself available for that as well.
Two great bits of advice. I just remember one time when I was going through my first fundraising around, and my attorney, the associate at the law firm, would call me to kind of talk about how the round is going and all the next steps. And I was happy to talk to them. But after a little bit, I was then trying to get her off the phone because I knew I was getting charged for this. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, nickel and diming. She was just being very nice, but so verbose. And so, by you actually saying that and hopefully telling that up front to your clients, it really takes a big load off their mind that they're not getting billed for every moment that they spend with you.
Oh, absolutely. And look, and the practice of law has changed to a certain extent too. There's things that are now done on a fixed fee basis, especially for startups. So you don't have to worry so much about spending that kind of time. Again, there's going to be challenges in doing that because unfortunately, as much as I know people think, isn't every convertible note deal a straightforward note deal? And isn't every Series C deal a straightforward Series C deal? I can tell you they're not. We just closed, literally yesterday, a $1.5 million Series Seed financing that I can honestly say is the most complicated Series Seed financing that I've done in 32 years of practicing law. And there's no way you could have foresaw where the investors were going to go with this and the things they were going to ask for and how complicated they were going to make it. And that's kind of the unfortunate part about what we do is while I can tell a client, hey, I can give you the documents for a perfect, you know, convertible note financing with the terms we've discussed for, you know, call it $2,500, right? It's cheap. It's easy. It's automated. We know exactly how these things are supposed to look. Here it is. But you can't control the investors who come in and want to make changes and bring in their other attorneys. And before you know it, you've gone down a morass of all kinds of issues and challenges and questions, and it gets expensive.
So now that you've mentioned the convertible note, let's take a deeper dive into fundraising process. And when is the appropriate time for a founder to think about fundraising?
Immediately. I always like to joke about, I've never had a client who went out of business because they raised too much money. So, you know, go get the money, especially when the money's there. The reality is the markets work in cycles. We all know that. And there are times when money's available and money's somewhat cheap. And then you can find a time where suddenly that money is not available and when you really need it. So the one thing I always tell people is, obviously, get your budget, figure out what you're going to need to get to different milestones. You don't want to obviously bring in so much money that you've diluted yourself terribly early on before you really created any value, but you also don't want to cut it too tight and too short. You want to give yourself enough leeway because, again, I've worked with literally hundreds, if not thousands of companies now over 30 years. And I would be very hard pressed to come up with a company that actually met every single deadline and never had you know, setbacks and didn't have cost overruns and didn't have issues where they had to change the technology or, you know, go back out to customers and rework things. And so it's just always going to take longer and always going to cost more than you've projected. That's just the reality. So, you know, you need to raise money early on. Again, if you're fortunate and you made a bunch of money in a prior deal and you can fund it yourself, of course do that, right? And if you can fund your company through revenue, whether it's licensing deals, upfront licensing deals, development deals, of course do that, right? Anything you can do that's not requiring you to give up equity, if you can get enough money to grow your business, I tell clients, pursue those and do those. But don't starve yourself for capital, because that's really going to be, it's a competitive advantage, right? We see that in Silicon Valley versus so many other parts of this country where people are trying to build businesses. Yeah, there's a lot of really smart people in Silicon Valley, and yeah, there's a lot of, you know, great experience that they can tap into. But there's also a lot of capital, and that is a competitive advantage.
Right.
Well, one of the deals that I've seen quite a few deals recently where it's investors are giving money to companies based on performance and money's coming in tranches. Have you seen more of those too? And what do you normally advise your clients when investors are more open to doing something like that rather than all the money up front?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm seeing more of it. I think I've always seen that. And I think that makes sense. I'm not sure it's smart to just, you know, dump $10 million into a company. I had a great entrepreneur who said something wonderful, and this is, you know, probably 20 years ago that's always stuck with me, and that is that money makes you stupid. And I just love that, because if you have too much money, you kind of don't continue to really watch every single cent. You don't really try to be as efficient as you can. And again, the dot-com era and certainly what we've seen in the last couple of years sort of prove that, right? Everybody running around with fancy offices and air on chairs and overspending on things that just didn't matter and weren't going to drive revenue. So I'd say, you know, we see those. I wouldn't say that they've been on an uptick. And I think those are rational and reasonable. Obviously, there's some challenges. It makes them a little more expensive to do because you have to figure out what's the milestone and what's going to trigger that payment. And everybody always thinks, well, but once you hit that milestone, the money comes in. It's never that simple. It's always other conditions, other requirements. And so it can add some expense to bringing the money in. But as an investor, I think it's probably a smart thing to do, right? To say, look, you know, we know that you've laid out milestones of what you have to do to get to, whether it's, you know, minimally viable product, or whether it's to your beta or whatever it may be. So we're going to go ahead and trickle that money out as you need it and as you hit those milestones. And if you hit them, great, then the next tranche becomes available. I think it's probably a rational way to fund companies.
Andrew, do they typically, in those performance tranches, escrow the money? Or is it just coming out of the pockets?
You know, I've never actually participated in one of those performance-based ones, but I think it's more a contract that says if you hit said milestones, then you money.
It's not typically escrowed because the investors don't want to have the money sitting there. Again, yeah. Think about, you know, from an investor perspective, right? Everything's about IRR, right? The internal rate of return.
Right.
And that's driven by when do I put the dollars to work. So having money sitting on an escrow account is just just really dragging down the IRR, right? Because that money's not invested in the business. It's not going to be getting that, you know, hopefully, you know, 20 times, you know, 20 IRR. So it's very rare. I'd say I'm not sure I can even come up with one where it was actually escrowed.
Right. As a founder, of course, I would love that for there to be a objective evaluation of hitting the milestone as opposed to subjective and people kind of changing their minds of putting their hands in their pocket to take out the wallet.
Exactly. And that's the risk. And unfortunately, yeah. There really is no such thing as a truly objective milestone.
Yeah. What are some of the pitfalls that you've seen, Jeremy, during the fundraising process or even fundraising fails or founder fails?
Sure. Well, you know, I'd say really starting from the very beginning, and that is that it's really important that you have an executive summary that is speaking to the investor. And I'd say that's probably, you know, the most typical, quote, issue, you know, problem that I see. And that is that the typical founder is coming out of a technology business, whether it's in biotechnology or med devices or software or mobile, whatever it is. So they really know their technology and they love their technology and they want to talk about their technology. But what they don't understand is that, yeah, investors want to understand the technology, of course, for, you know, competitive reasons and for market reasons. But the investor cares a lot more about how they're going to get rich than about whether or not your technology is going to be, you know, changing the world technology. And so probably the biggest issue I see is that the very early stage when they're drafting that executive summary, they're not focusing on that the investor needs to understand what's your revenue model? How are you going to charge for this product? And have you done any market research as to whether or not that price is going to hold up in the market? Are people willing to pay that? So you sort of either it's skipped over completely or even worse, which I could tell you is an absolute no-no. You see people do the classic, you know, it's a $5 billion market. And if we only get 1%, you know, that's never going to fly with an investor who knows anything about investing. So I'd say people need to, yes, explain your technology, but you also need to make sure that you really understand from a bottoms-up approach, where do the customers come from? What are they going to pay? What is it going to take as an investment to get those customers in the door to pay? So you have a real understanding of the revenue ramp and how you're going to get this company, if not profitable, at least growing in revenue so you could theoretically sell it or take it public or whatever the potential exit's going to be. I'd say that's probably the biggest issue I see. And unfortunately, I see it over and over again.
Yeah, because I could just imagine some founders would be like of the mind of, isn't it obvious this product I'm putting in front of you? Maybe you're not quite understanding it because you're not hip to technology, but any one of us can understand it and try to embarrass the investor into saying, okay, I agree with you. Here's my money.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
That's not going to work.
You almost have to make it so a five-year-old can understand exactly what's going on in an investment pitch. That's for sure.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm thinking about some other things that tend to be, you know, problematic for early stage companies. I'd say another thing that I see when they're raising money is this focus on, and I'll use the term dilution, and there's sort of a misunderstanding of what that term means. But unfortunately, a lot of founders get so focused on how much of the business am I going to be owning, and therefore control. And I can tell you again, from worked with, you know, hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 companies over these years, that never leads to a good place. If you start focusing on, gee, how am I going to keep control of the business? Likelihood is you're going to start making a lot of decisions that actually hurt the ability of the business to succeed and grow. And so I try to explain to people, of course, you know, you want to take the money at the appropriate increments when you've built value, when your valuation has gone up enough, so you're not obviously giving away 60, 70, 80% of the company at a very early stage. But don't get overly focused on, is the investor going to take 25% or 33%? And is, you know, the valuation going to be, you know, 10 million or 8 million? The reality is, if the business succeeds, you're going to make a gob of money with the ownership you have. And if your ownership gets too small, the reality is, if you're doing a good job in building that business, the investors know that they got to make sure that you're going to do okay on the back end. They're going to step up and give you options or give you restricted stock, right, and get you back up to an appropriate percentage. So one of the greatest things that I heard, and it still sits with me after 20 years, a very successful entrepreneur who built a very successful company, actually in Texas, but ended up moving here to San Diego, where he was very involved in our technology community, stood up in front of a bunch of people when he was talking about when he makes investments. And he said, I've gotten to the point now where I really just try to get the answer to one question, and that determines whether I'm going to invest. And that question is to the founder, would you rather be rich or do you really just want to be CEO? And I love that question because to me it encompasses so many of the issues that as an investor you need to understand, and as a founder you need to understand what the investor's concerned about. You got to be focused on the right end goal, which is everybody building a big successful business. It's not about fighting over who's going to have the bigger piece at the end.
Rising tide lifts all ships, right?
Exactly.
So as we wrap up, we'd love to let people know how they can find you.
Of course.
What's your social media game?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm actually pretty active on social media, so you can certainly follow me on Twitter. I'm at SDVCLawyer. I'm on Twitter quite a bit, but mostly posting articles that are particularly relevant to founders, entrepreneurs about financing a business, writing exec summaries, getting to successful exits, or interesting stuff on technology that I'm reading. You can always, of course, go to the Mintz websites, either mintz.com, M-I-N-T-Z.com, or mintzedge.com, which is more focused on early stage companies. And by the way, just a quick plug for that, we have a lot of really good resources. It's all for free, including links out to the sites that we find really valuable for entrepreneurs to go to. So I would highly recommend you go there. And then, of course, I'm on LinkedIn. You could always look up Jeremy Glazer on LinkedIn and find me there. And my email is jglazer@mintz.com. Please feel free to send me emails. I respond to every email I get.
Thanks for those, Jeremy. Those are great resources, especially to the Mintz Edge links. If you want to find us, you could tweet us at Startup Talk Pod, tweet me personally at Millard Y. Chan, email us at startuptalkpodcast@gmail.com, or check out our website at startuptalkpodcast.com. Please rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps more people find us. So that concludes another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew.
Let's get started.
Hey, folks. Please subscribe to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew on iTunes and rate and review us. It helps other people find this podcast. This episode was produced by Millard Chan and Andrew Moss. Our sound editor is Lee Liang. Additional voices from Mindy Nguyen. Our theme music is Good Times by Poddington Bear from soundofpicture.com. Our podcast Sherpa is Charles Wilchett.